Today's program was brought to you by S. Wallace Edwards & Sons, producing the country's best dry, cured, and aged hams, bacon, and sausage using 100% pasture-raised, certified humane Berkshire cuts. For more information, visit edwardsvaham.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hey America, I'm Chad Pagano. I'm a former Army sniper, a chef instructor at the Institute of Culinary Education, and an avid lifelong hunter, and you're about to experience the Wild Game Domain from the Hunt to the Hearth, airing live on heritageradionetwork.org. And today is a historic day here at the Wild Game Domain. If you tuned in last week, we had a great guest. That we had the brilliant mind of Michael Schwartz, Chef Michael Schwartz, who is the half of the brains and all of the brawn behind Bao Food and Drink, a great company, which we'll talk about a little bit today. I think it's going to come up. And he has agreed to sign on as my co-host. Thank God above that he's coming aboard, because I could really use the help. If you've listened to the shows I do by myself, I think you'll agree with me. He's a brilliant chef. He's a great guy, even more importantly, and he's funny as all hell. So I think he's going to be pretty good. I think he's going to end up being like the straight man of the show a little bit. And he came in today talking about some TPP thing. He's like, all right, we got to talk about I'm like, oh my God, he's going to challenge me, because I didn't even know what this TPP thing is. But we're going to talk about that next week. So welcome aboard, Mike.
Thanks, Chad. It's great to be back.
Okay, so if you've been listening to the show, we did a couple episodes ago, I don't know, 10 episodes ago, we did a show, I believe Jesse and I, about food preservation, especially wild game preservation, and some of the techniques and how to execute these techniques safely, properly, and so the meat will remain delicious. And I thought, with a fermentation expert now being my partner, we could take this a little bit further and understand it a little more. For the hunter, at least, it all starts with the kill, And so if you're lucky enough to acquire, how do I put this nicely, acquire a fresh kill, or if you've harvested a live animal, that's how I like to talk to the liberals, because I try to not offend them. In other words, I just sent my Eastern 250 arrow with a Rage broadhead, expandable broadhead, 25 yards downrange from my Matthews 65-pound bow, hit it in the shoulder, broke through its shoulder blade, right into its vital area. It was a pass-through. I saw the deer wobble, and it went about 20 yards, and we'll call it bedded down for a while. If we are lucky enough to experience that, that's really when the work starts for us hunters, And for me, it immediately starts with a field dressing of that animal. So these larger animals that we kill can be a challenge as far as field dressing. The one advantage we have that's built into hunting is that we only hunt when it's cold, pretty much. Usually these kills are happening beginning mid-November, upstate New York. We got generally temperatures under 40 degrees, but we just killed this animal, and as we know, there's warmth in this animal, and I got to try to get these guts out as quickly as possible. And I've talked about this already, my difficulty with gutting, or more politely saying, field dressing my animal. My problem is when I shoot male animals, I have a hard time cutting off their testicles. It rings
too close to home.
Yeah, too close to home for me. But first thing I do is slice off their testicles, to put it nicely. Long incision from basically the point of the testicles up to the sternum, being very careful not to cut or damage any of the intestines. Obviously, the stomach wall we want to keep intact. After making this incision cleanly, I generally cut around the anus of the animal. I try to pull the anus back in through the animal, And then turn it over on its side, spilling all the guts from the animal. There's always some connective tissue on the backside. I got to reach in, cut that away, get up into the chest cavity, generally rip the heart out. The diaphragm tends to cling to the back of the animal, so that's got to be cut away. And then I reach up as far as I can, grabbing the esophagus and cutting as much of the esophagus out of the animal. At that point, I drag, and I'm racing through this because we've covered all this in detail. I drag my animal back to my staging area, my campsite, my parking area, wherever it may be. And for me, I try to hang the animal at this point for a little while to let excess blood drain off and come out of the animal. I was always taught to hang the animal with its head up for some reason. Maybe.
Really?
Yeah, so maybe you could,
I don't know.
No idea.
That's what you don't cut the throat and let it hang head down?
No.
Huh.
Yeah. I mean, the head is a part of the animal I never use. So maybe someday we
how's the blood get out?
Do a show. It just kind of pools in the bottom of the cavity there and then builds up, pours over. So as I push the animal a little bit, it all pours off. I mean, it escapes. I don't know. Maybe that's a bad thing. Maybe I should. I've seen people hanging deer head first, and I've done it out of necessity where I didn't want to cut. And usually what I'll do is on the hind legs, on the front legs, I'll cut through the tendons and use I think it's called a gramble, and kind of hoist the deer up that way. So now it's open. You know, for me it's more about, because I never understood, and maybe you could explain it in a minute, the process of hanging and blooding an animal, and what happens with the lactic acids and all that. I know it has something to do with that. But, you know, I'll hang the animal out of convenience and basically just to let cool air through it. And the system, the gramble, actually opens up the body cavity a little bit because the front legs are spread wide apart and I feel like air circulates better. I'll go as far as paper towels in there and kind of wipe out any of the remaining bad stuff, you know, leftover guts, connective tissue, deer shit that you'll find in there.
You can say that on the radio?
Yeah, you can say shit.
Really?
Shit. It doesn't matter. It's fine. It's great. I haven't gotten much further than shit yet, but maybe we'll get there.
All right.
So, you know, and now, so that was the field dressing and basically the hanging, and you know, as you know, my audience, for me, that's basically where my connection, unfortunately, ends with the animal for the most part. I usually take it to a butcher at this point and get him to hack it up for me. This year, I had the luxury of having a personal butcher come to my house, a friend of the family, and actually I watched him butcher a deer, or at least do the primal cuts for me. And then I went through the hell of deboning and trying to cut stew meats and some simple cuts, which was a bigger story. And in modern times, you know, I know we're spoiled. You know, when I use a butcher, it comes back vacuum sealed for the most part, at a minimum, already frozen, wrapped in butcher's paper. And I put it in my freezer and break it out as necessary, and I use it. But, you know, I think the wild game domain and myself as a hunter, you know, I think we want to try to get, first of all, more hands on the animal. We want to be more involved with the process from the kill all the way to the table. So that's what I want to talk to you about today. And I want to talk about some alternatives that the hunter, the sustainable foodie can use on really any meats to preserve these meats in a more natural and I don't know, historic or classic way, and that's why I'm going to turn the show over to you now. You know, for me it's freezing, hanging,
right.
You know, smoking, you know, salt. You make lox, right? Is that
right.
What you make?
Yep.
Yeah. When he was at the school a lot, I couldn't wait. You know, when I knew when he was making lox, I'd find a bagel somewhere if you can't find a bagel in New York. And, you know, it was like a glorious day. He makes the best lox. He pack it with, I don't know, salt, sugar, whatever he did. That's all been done already. I think most of our audience knows about that stuff. So what else can I do?
Right. So all the preservation methods that you just talked about, refrigeration, vacuum sealing, canning, those are all kind of modern techniques, right? And so without technology, and sometimes really advanced technology, they're, and electricity, they're completely useless.
Right.
Right. Unless you're living in New York City in the middle of winter. Right. Right? But refrigeration, without electricity, it all goes to hell in the summer.
Right. Well, everyone, you voted for your current mayor, so deal with it when you don't have any electricity.
I don't vote in New York, so can't blame that one on me.
Me either.
All right. So, but for thousands of years, for at least 2,000 years, the main method of preservation for meats was salting and curing, right? And so the history of salami making, which is a great preservation method, goes back to, you know, the Mediterranean at least 2,000 years ago. And it all comes down to salt, right? So you mentioned the lox, or the gravlox, that we used to make at school. So that's one method. And so the salami making is another method where you grind up the meat and you actually incorporate the meat into, or incorporate the salt into the meat. And then there's a process of drying. And sometimes you inoculate it with a bacteria, usually some variation of lactobacillus, just like we talked about last week.
Now, is that done naturally? You inoculate. You used a fancy word there. Now, that tells me...
It can be done both ways.
Okay.
Right? So, I mean, 2,000 years ago, there was no inoculation.
Right.
Right? It just naturally occurs. And if you, out in your garage, in your backyard, if you make a lot of salami, right, and a lot of sauerkraut and a lot of fermented things, you will develop a microculture, micro ecosystem of different types of bacteria that will, and yeasts and other things that will live in your garage, and it will self-inoculate. Right. And this is probably what happened. I mean, you know, 2,000 years ago, right, when the Romans started to make salamis, I bet some of them didn't work out so good, and the result wasn't so happy for the people who ate it.
Right.
Right. And somebody got lucky. And so the people that got lucky continued on and developed this really amazing method of preservation, which is completely natural, completely sustainable. You don't need refrigeration to get it done.
Okay.
You can do it in a basement, even in a hot summer. It's cool enough to get it done.
Okay.
Correctly.
So, but let's start at the beginning. I got this animal hanging. Quarter it out. Is there a better cut of meat from this deer that I should be using? The leg?
Well,
the-
first of all, whether it's a deer or that you harvested, or a piece of meat that you harvested from the grocery store.
We can say ruthlessly shot now. I don't even care anymore.
Or if you do your harvesting from the grocery store.
Right.
Right.
Which is more humane. Did I ever tell you? Hold on. I don't mean to interrupt you. You're going to love this one. I got an email from a listener. I hope you're still out there. We love you. I'm a libertarian. And she emailed me. She said, just a quick question. Why don't you just buy your meat from the grocery store, where it's all done humanely and safely, and no animals suffer during the process.
Right. And you've seen all those movies about how humanely the American industry is with treating animals
versus so my 150, you know, Remington Corlock 30-06, 150 grain bullet passing through the vitals and ending that deer's life before it could even blink an eye. All right. So
anyway,
I'm sorry. Yeah.
So wherever you harvest your meat from, it's really important that it's naturally raised meat. So your deer was most likely naturally raised, right? It ate grass, berries, whatever the heck.
Maybe
field crops. Whatever the hell deer eat. I don't know.
Depending on where they're living, you know. They're very resilient.
If you harvest your meat from the grocery store, it should also be naturally raised.
I like that.
So if it's fed corn and soy and all kinds of industrial garbage, then the chances of you getting a bad pathogen or a bad microorganism mixed into your salami is exponentially greater. Whereas if you use a piece of naturally raised meat, the animal's healthier. Mm-hmm. Aren't these residual antibiotics. There aren't there's not the antibiotic resistance. So you're probably going to have a healthier piece of meat, and it's much safer to turn into one of these cured products. And you're most likely to end up like one of the happy Romans rather than one of the sad puking Romans.
Right.
Right.
And that's just based on the resistance of the meat, right? From the
It's just based on the health of the animal when it's killed, when it's slaughtered.
Okay.
You know, I mean, a healthy animal makes healthy food, right? An animal that's given natural food and given it eats what it's supposed to eat is a healthier animal.
Right.
It's going to taste better. It's going to be safer to eat. It's all around. There's no losing.
Right.
Right. So then I completely took you off track.
No.
So what cuts are better?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, typically the tougher cuts are more flavorful. So the shoulder, the legs,
right.
That what's the ham on the pig, the hind leg,
right?
Those are tougher cuts because that's where the animal gets the most exercise, and those cuts tend to have more flavor. So those are better for making these cured ground up pieces of salami, etc.
Right.
Whereas if you could save the tender cuts like the rib and the loin for, you know, to saute or to cook on the barbecue,
sure.
or whatever.
Yeah, and that's what I usually do. I mean, I'm talented enough to at least get a loin out of an animal, you know, and what deer hunt is, and maybe we could later, if we get a second, talk about this, what I call the loin and the back strap. I don't know if they're the same thing.
What does it look like?
It looks like a skirt steak. So it's the inside of the loin, the underside of the loin.
Yeah.
So when I'm, after I got the animal out, I have access to its spine, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's where the loin comes from on both sides of the spine, right?
Right. Well, so you have the loin on the top and you have the tenderloin on the bottom.
All right. So it must be the tender.
It could be the tender. It's kind of long and skinny.
No. See, that's what deer hunters call the loin of deer. It's long and skinny, but clean, very fat.
But on the top side, on the outside of that?
No, it's on the inside,
actually. The tenderloin.
See, on a deer, when you cut a deer open, there's what looks like a skirt steak.
Right, so it probably is a skirt. Skirt steak is kind of connects the is attached to the diaphragm. It's a diaphragm.
Yeah,
so
right.
Like there are two parts of the diaphragm. There's a skirt steak and the hanger. So the skirt steak is the diaphragm. It goes right in between.
Right.
It separates the heart and lungs from the stomach.
Right. Well, I don't know anything about that because the heart and lungs are already out. I've been closing my eyes and holding my nose the whole time, getting all these guts out. But then when I look back there in the cleaned animal, there's what I call. We call them back straps, and they're inside the animal, and I kind of clean those out very easily. They come out very easily,
and it has a lot of fat in between
it
it's probably
just
the hanger
like a store-bought
steak. I mean, it's probably
skirt
the hanger steak, skirt
hanger.
Steak,
yeah. And then at that point, that gives me access to the proper loin,
right?
You know,
right.
And that's when I butcher the loin out, and then I'm throwing that on the grill.
How much does a deer weigh?
It depends. You know, anywhere the deer I shot this year dressed out at 140, I think.
I mean, because they must be pretty small.
They're small.
The skirt steak and what do you call it?
The backstrap.
That's the tenderloin. Even that must be pretty small.
The loin. The loin and the backstrap are two separate things.
Right.
I'll bring some in.
You're supposed to bring some in this week.
I know, but it's still frozen.
Thanks.
And because I'm too busy. I got every excuse. All right. Unfortunately, we got to take a break here.
All right.
Then we're going to get right back, and we're going to get back on topic, and we're going to make this happen. So I'm your host. I'm joined by my co-host, Michael Schwartz, and we'll be right back with the Wild Game Domain.
This one's called Onions Milk by Iggy Dean. You're listening to the Wild Game Domain on the HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
The following program was brought to you by S. Wallace Edwards & Sons. Edwards Suriano hams are aged to perfection for no less than 400 days and hickory smoked to achieve a deep mahogany color. The Edwards name is well known for its world-class aged and cured meats. Their exclusive curing and aging recipe produces a unique flavor profile that enhances the quality characteristics of Berkshire pork. Optimum amounts of pure white fat marbling contribute to a flavor that's a delicate, perfect balance between sweet and salty. For more information, visit edwardsvaham.com.
For a second and see my machine?
You just talked over.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's all right. See my co-host, Mike Schwartz, the new co-host. Welcome back. You're listening to Wild Game Domain. I'm Chad Pagano, and we have my co-host, Michael Schwartz.
Sorry, I don't know the rules yet.
No, we don't really have a lot of time for anything, but right. We could discuss that after the show because I'm in the weeds after this. All right, let's get to it. Forget backstraps, loins, who cares?
Right.
That's not what we're here to talk about. We're here to talk about basically the technique of curing. Which is the technique used for making salami?
Yep.
Or am I simplifying?
Yeah, no.
And
salami, prosciutto, it's all grab locks, it's all basically the same thing.
And let me play dumb for a second, which I'm really good at. Okay, so we got the hindquarter.
Yep.
I deboned it.
Ham.
A ham. It's not referred to as a ham by any hunter on the face of the earth, but okay. The ham of the deer.
Right. Or you got the hindquarter, you got the loin, you got a lot of pieces still?
Sure.
Completely boned out.
Whatever you want. You want. And now I grind it.
Sure.
Make chopped meat out of it.
Right.
Effectively. And I'm introducing salt.
Right.
First thing. Most important. Because that's going to, A, draw out moisture.
Correct.
And that renders it safe by itself?
Nope.
No. Okay. So,
salt and thyme. And humidity. And temperature. So all of those things. So, you know, you did a really good job. You field dress the animal, and you didn't break into the stomach or the bowel, and you got all the bad stuff out, and you didn't let any of the juices from the intestines taint the meat.
Right.
But there's still millions of varieties of microorganisms all over this thing.
Well, as soon as I killed this animal, it's immune system obviously stopped working.
Sure.
And we're talking about as quickly as I could work. I mean, we're talking about hours.
And it's
hours.
Cold. So it's cold.
Right.
So, you know, you're in good shape. You're doing the right thing. It's cold. You are doing the best you can to keep the pathogens to a minimum. But there's bacteria everywhere. And so, you know, you have a very vibrant micro ecosystem going on in us and in this animal. And so your job is to encourage the good bacteria, best case scenario, or worst case scenario, discourage everything, right? So what we do in a modern kitchen, you know, constantly we teach sanitation, right? How many sanitation classes have you taught?
It's not an option.
Right, sanitation is not an option. So we try to kill everything.
Right.
When you sanitize, you don't have an option. You can't discriminate between pathogens and beneficial bacteria, right? But 2,000 years ago and in a natural world, you don't have these modern sanitizers. You don't have bleach, which is horrible for the environment. You don't have all these chemicals to put on the animals. You don't have nitrogen flush, and, you know, you have... So you have to the best case scenario is to encourage the good bacteria and discourage the bad bacteria, and salt is one of those things. So salt, just like we talked about last week, discourages microbiological growth. Right?
Okay.
And in small quantities, it has the habit of encouraging lactobacillus growth. So you're going to mix salt into the meat. You're going to draw off moisture. When you mix salt into the meat, you're also going to mix in lots of spices. Herbs, spices, flavorings, because through osmosis, when the salt enters the cell structure of the meat, it also pulls all of those flavors in there. So you're going to get a much more flavorful product.
It's doing the same thing to the herbs, to the flavors. It's drawing the flavor, the moisture out of those herbs, and everything's blending.
Right. So you make a salt mix, maybe some sugar too, and the spices, and you mix it all together, and then you mix it into the meat, or you don't have to grind it up. You could take that whole back leg and rub the salt on the outside, right, and hang it and make, like, prosciutto.
Prosciutto, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
You submerge it in salt. You pack the salt on there. You let it sit in there for a few days, depending on, you know, how big the piece is, whether the bone's in there or not in there. And then you wipe off the extra salt and you hang it. Same curing method. So through time, the salt is going to penetrate in deep into the muscle.
Okay, but let's put some time frames on this. Now, I mix my salt, sugar, I got all the goodness, flavor in there. I mix it up in a big bowl. You're packaging this or
okay, so you're going to stuff it. You're going to wash the casings is a nice word we use for intestines.
Yep.
So you're going to wash the casings, right? And then stuff the meat back in the casing, or you could use you would never do this, but some people might use a synthetic casing.
Yeah.
Or you don't have to use a casing.
Okay.
Right? Or there's some parts of the animal that you could you use as a wrap. So you'd have to wrap it and then tie it with some butcher's twine or something.
Okay.
Right. And then you need to get it into an environment where there's controlled humidity, right, and controlled temperature. So you don't want it too hot.
And right? what range are we in here?
We're in like the a little bit more than 40.
Okay, right? And up to
not depend. Well, it depends. Typically, not more than 48, 50.
Okay,
I mean it's still pretty cool.
Okay, and that's right? why they use these curing rooms or yeah. whatever they call them
sure.
down
basement.
In the basement. Yeah.
Basement, yeah,
where it maintains this you know yeah. temperature all year. Even in July,
right.
my basement has
right.
a cool feel to it.
Exactly.
Right. Okay, exactly. And then the hanging itself is just to allow for what
air? It's to allow for airflow, so right. you don't have to hang it. You could put it on racks. Right? So could everybody see what I'm doing right now?
Yep.
You could put the meat...
I'll tell you later. Don't worry about it.
You can put it on racks.
He's imitating a rack with his hands. If you could envision this. You know, put your hands out in front of you and open your fingers.
There's no screen? They don't have a screen?
No. Oh. Well, we'll get there. Now that you're aboard and they see the handsomeness of both of us. We actually look
twins.
Somewhat alike. It's really weird looking at him.
Right. So... So you need airflow. So you want as much airflow as possible to surround the items so that they can the water can evaporate evenly, right?
Okay.
So if it's sitting in a pan and the juices are collecting in the bottom of the pan, then the bottom part of the meat's going to have too much liquid. It's going to rot. It's not going to cure at the same rate.
Right.
You're not going to end up with a consistent
product. Because the more liquid, the more bacteria attraction.
Yeah.
It's just going to throw the whole
yeah.
balance.
Right.
Of
and
this.
You don't have the same evaporation. So
right. Okay, and so how long does this take? I start it on Sunday morning. Am I eating this Sunday night?
No, probably not.
Probably not, right?
Your days or weeks or sometimes months.
Right.
Depends on the type of product that you're making.
Now, is there a specific for the amateur? I mean, guys, he just explained how to do it. Go for it. I know you got a leg of venison sitting in the freezer. Do something with it.
Yeah.
Try it. Go for it. You're not. It's going to sit there and freeze dry, you know, and freezer burn. So try this. Now,
Don't ask me for a recipe right now.
No, we're not.
Okay.
We're not. I'll try to...
I can post
Some. Yeah. Chef Mike will post one for you, but... or you could, you know what?
All you have to do
We're not going to post one.
Do you have
do
Google?
A little research. Yeah, Google.
Do they have Google?
I think,
Google?
I don't know. If you have Google, right. Google is capable of telling you anything.
Sure.
So go to Google and ask it. But physical signs, little tricks. Like, okay, so I've been hanging this thing. It's 7 weeks into the game now. Too long?
Probably.
All right, 4 weeks.
Yeah.
3 weeks.
Maybe.
Okay.
Yeah.
What am I looking for? Is there a physical sign? Can I feel it? Touch
yeah, you
it,
can
lick
feel
it.
It's going to be firm, right? Oftentimes, you get some harmless white yeast accumulating on the outside.
That's good.
Wonderful.
Right.
Yeah. Yep. You can that you can probe. You can take. There's a little like it's like a needle, and you can stick a needle in one and pull out a piece, so you can see.
Oh, like take a plug.
Yeah, you take a plug out exactly, so you can see the consistency. And after you do it a couple of times, you're going to see. You know, you're going to get to the point where you'll just be able to touch it and
I love
exactly
that answer. That's the answer I wanted. It's a craft.
Yeah.
You got to do it. You just can't.
Do it a couple times.
You know, so there you go. It's going to get white, hopefully. You're going to feel it. You're going to be looking for texture or firmness of it. Take a plug off it.
Or sacrifice one. Cut it in half.
Thank you. I was just going to say,
right,
you know
I
what?
Mean,
I'm not going, you know, I'm not Googling finding a salami
right.
plug machine.
Right.
So I'm
yeah,
going to
make
the end.
So worst case scenario, right, you cure it for 3 days, probably not enough time, right? And you're like, oh, I think this is done. And so you take one link down, and you cut it in half, and it's not dry enough inside. So you put it in the frying pan, and you fry it up, and you eat it.
Yeah.
And then you cooked it, and it's good to go.
I love it.
Right? And then you let the rest of them cure a little longer.
You make an egg sandwich.
You make
like
an egg sandwich.
Kale or ham.
Exactly.
Or
yeah, you put a little bao roslaw on top with your salami and a little bun that you got from Chef Chad's Bake Shop, and
that's a
you're
good point,
to go.
Though, by the way. You know, as we know, this guy runs that company, Bao, which I freaking could have invested in Jennifer, my wife. And, you know, money was falling out of his pocket when he was coming in here today with this company.
But, falling into my toilet, rather.
Yeah. But... he had last week gave me a jar of his raw slaw that I put on my hamburger that I made on pretzel rolls this week. I was all
nice.
It was excellent, man. The texture and the vinegariness of it. I love that product. I got to tell you, man, you're a natural. I know you've appeared on shows before, But this was your first...
I've got a much better face for radio.
First. I don't agree. I think you're very handsome. You know, I think he's very handsome. He's tall. You got to see him.
I'm really tall.
He's tall. He's handsome. Girls, you should be... And boys, for that matter, if you're into that, you should be Googling Mike Schwartz. And a lot of pictures of me are going to come up for some reason, which is very funny. But... you did a great job, man.
Thanks,
welcome,
man.
Aboard.
It's great to be back.
I'm glad to have you here. And unfortunately, that's all the time we have. And I'd like to thank Joe for producing and engineering today's show. You can always find archived episodes of The Wild Game Domain, From the Hunt to the Hearth, at heritageradionetwork.org or on iTunes as a podcast. Thank you very much. See you next week.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.